Welcome to The Signal. I'm Amy Brierley.
And I'm Lucia Helder. We're here with the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism.
Today on the show, a firsthand account of anti-Chinese harassment in Halifax as the COVID-19 virus continues to spread.
It's not an issue that the Chinese people are facing. It's an issue that the world is facing.
And we'll hear why people in Halifax are taking action to support Wet'suwet'en land protectors.
The RCMP is invading all their traditional territories and removing peaceful protesters.
And later, how food programs at the library are bringing the community together.
An apple may just look like an apple, but boy, it does so much more.
Plus, we'll get an update on a story about the nurses at the East Coast Forensic Hospital who were exposed to THC. All that and more on today's show.
But first, the coronavirus, now known as COVID-19, continues to spread, mostly in China. But closer to home, another scourge is also spreading. Earlier this month, a Chinese restaurant in Sydney, Cape Breton, posted a sign saying Chinese students were banned out of fear of spreading the virus. And some Asian people have reported being harassed on the streets. Abigail Trevino has more.
Laura Deakin Clark was on her way to the Park Lane movie theater when she stopped at a crosswalk. Two South Asian people were also waiting for the light to change when a car pulled up at the corner of Dresden Row and Spring Garden.
The woman in the passenger seat rolled down her window. She just looked at them and said, "Coronavirus," like very, like, quick, and then, you know, started laughing. There was two other passengers in the car, and they all started laughing, and, you know, I stepped in front of the two friends and kind of was just like, F you, like, that's super racist.
Deakin Clark says she was shocked. She tried to get the license plate of the car, but it sped off before she could write it down.
The light changed and we were walking across the street and I was like, hey, you know, are you guys okay? And you could tell that they were very, like, upset by it, but the response was that it wasn't an uncommon occurrence with them and that they had experienced similar things and that their friends had also experienced similar situations. It was super upsetting.
She says the best way to deal with situations like this as an ally is to call them out.
Everyone who has that privilege needs to do that. And really, like, even if you're uncomfortable doing it, just do it.
Naressa Zhang is a first-year University of King's College student who is originally from China. She's also seen xenophobia firsthand on social media.
There's a lot of comments. I would say a majority of the comments under the post are kind of like quite mean, which I feel not comfortable at the first time when I reading this.
Zhang blames fake news for stoking fear, as well as cultural differences. She says for Chinese people, wearing a mask is seen as a way to both protect yourself and others. Many non-Chinese people, though, see it as something only contagious people do, stoking fears that many more people are infected than numbers being reported. Dr. Robert Strang is the Chief Medical Officer of Health for the province of Nova Scotia. He says not only is it racist to avoid contact with Asian people in restaurants, it also won't work.
We have a globalized world now, and people of any background could be ones that are traveling to and from China. And many people who may, of Chinese origin, they may have been here for multiple generations and may not have ever traveled out of Canada. So it's unfortunate that people are making these kind of judgments based on how somebody looks.
Strang says there's no cause for concern for Canadians, and the overall risk of catching the virus is still very low. He says regular seasonal flu still poses a much higher risk to the Canadian public. He recommends staying home if sick, frequent hand washing, and getting a flu shot. For The Signal, I'm Abigail Trevino.
For the past week, the call to shut down Canada has spurred blockades from coast to coast in solidarity with Wet'suwet'en elders in BC. A court-ordered injunction prompted the arrest of those blocking access to a pipeline site, which is on Wet'suwet'en territory. In Halifax, more than 150 people gathered earlier this week to block access to the Fairview Cove container terminal. Dominique Amit has the story.
The blockade lasted for 5 hours. It's one of several actions that have taken place in Halifax in the last few days. I spoke to land protectors and their allies about why they were rallying for a cause where the bulk of the action is happening over 5,000 kilometers away.
We're here in solidarity of the West Sweden Nation, who has jurisdiction over 200,000 square kilometers of their traditional territories. The RCMP is invading all their traditional territories and removing peaceful protesters.
Members of Extinction Rebellion, including Jen Stotland, also took part in the blockade.
It's a continent-wide industrial system, and that's why we're here also operating to put this pipeline, which Trudeau nationalized, to put through Wet'suwet'en territory.
Darlene Gilbert goes by her Mi'kmaq name, Thunderbird Sleeping Down Woman. She says at one point during the blockade, a police vehicle was slowly moving towards the youth.
As when I turned around, I seen a police vehicle proceeding towards the youth. That's what grandmothers do. We step in front.
She says police weren't respecting the protesters. And Michelle Paul, a Mi'kmaq woman, says the removal and arrest of Wet'suwet'en land protectors is another violation of Indigenous rights.
That Article 10 of the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People says you cannot forcibly remove Indigenous people from their homelands and territories. This is unceded Mi'kma'ki, and this is, we're letting you know, we're letting Canada know that we do not accept the violence perpetrated on our family, our brothers and sisters in Unist'ot'en, Wet'suwet'en.
Similar actions continue across the country. Activists have occupied legislative buildings and shut down rail lines. Another rally is planned for tomorrow in Annapolis Royal to block Highway 1 on a causeway by the town. For The Signal, I'm Dominique Amit.
2 weeks ago, our colleagues on The Signal's video channel broke a story about nurses at the East Coast Forensic Hospital in Dartmouth who were exposed to synthetic THC. They became sick and were taken to hospital. Everyone's okay, although one nurse is refusing to go back to work. Now, officials are talking about how to improve security at the hospital, which is attached to the Provincial Correctional Center. Ellery Platts broke that story, and she's here to update us. So, Ellery, catch us up. How did the nurses get high and sick?
So, the patients at this hospital, on the rehab side especially, are many of them are substance abusers. So when they went out of the facility, they were smuggling drugs in, and then they came and smoked them into the bathrooms or the day rooms. And when that smoke got into the air, it was transferred throughout the unit, and then in turn, the nurses got sick through the exposure.
And how do the patients get the drugs inside the facility?
Well, like I said before, a lot of them can go out when they're just in the rehab unit. So some of the privileges that they have are they can go out into the community for a day from the morning to the night. They just have to stay overnight. And then when they do get back, they're just kind of airport security padded down and then sent back in. So it makes it very easy for them to smuggle in drugs.
So one nurse is refusing to go back to work. What does her union say?
Well, the union is 100% behind her and supporting her. Jason McLean is the president for the Nova Scotia Government Employees Union, and they're the ones that represent those nurses.
We have one problem that presents itself repeatedly is the policies that are over on the correction side in terms of maintaining a safe facility aren't adhered to or recognized by the hospital side.
And the hospital is operated by the Nova Scotia Health Authority. How do they respond?
Well, I talked to Dr. Peter Scott Terrio. He's the clinical director of addictions and mental health for the authority. He says the other option that they have is if you're found or the patients are found with these drugs, their privileges are put on hold until they can review the circumstances under which the drugs came into their possession.
Well, I don't know that we're anticipating doing anything significantly different. I mean, the other steps that you could do are much more invasive, and they would be a basic violation of the person's rights.
And Amy, I put a call out to the Department of Justice and the Department of Health, but I haven't heard back from either of them yet.
Thanks for the update, Ellery. And that's Ellery Platts with the video workshop here at the University of King's College School of Journalism.
A collaborative effort to deliver fresh fruits and veggies in places where food is hard to access is looking for new wheels. The mobile food market needs a new truck for deliveries. Currently, it depends on city vehicles, including off-duty metro buses. They're asking the city to contribute to the cost of a new truck. Yesterday, I visited a pop-up market in Spryfield that depends on the mobile food market service. At Chibucto Connections, just off Herring Cove Road in Spryfield, folks from around the area line up to buy food they can actually afford.
All right, so we have 4 bananas.
The market is open every other Wednesday afternoon. The aim of this program is to get fresh produce and bread into people's hands for a lower price than the grocery store. Shopper Lynn Thibodeau is a fan.
Oranges, 25 cents for an orange. You cannot beat that.
A banana costs 25 cents, bread costs $2, and a sack of potatoes costs $4. Karen Croft is a frequent shopper here. She hopes the market will soon carry affordable eggs and milk, too.
I've been coming to the market since they opened. It's so convenient for me. I just live down the street, and the prices meet what I need, because I can't afford. I mean, I'm on government assistance, so I have to be very careful with what I spend on food, because my rent is going up $125.
The local community center, where the market is being held, also offers market bucks, money given to shoppers to help them get what they need if they don't have enough. Kelly Keating is the program director at Chibucto Connections. She helps run the Spryfield food market.
So at a community market, there's choice involved. So allowing people to have that dignity and that autonomy to make those decisions about what they want to cook for themselves rather than what's left in the cupboard.
The mobile food market is a crucial part of what makes the Spryfield market possible. They negotiate with distributors to get cheaper prices, and they deliver the food to the community center. Adriana McKenzie is the executive director at the community center. She says if the mobile food market gets their own truck, the Spryfield market might have better times or be open more frequently.
We're limited with the day we can do the market based on when they have access to the truck in the grocery store. So our first choice would not necessarily be Wednesday at this time. So I think for us, the more flexibility they have, the more they can really do what the community needs, not just kind of make it work.
At a municipal council meeting this week, the city voted to see whether it can help the mobile food market buy a truck. People like Karen Croft have their fingers crossed and hope they can keep shopping here.
So, I really enjoy coming here. I mean, I think it's the best thing they could have for the neighborhood.
Going along with the food theme, Halifax libraries are getting some support for a program that battles social isolation through the comforts of food. The city's budget committee has unanimously approved $50,000 to support refreshment tables that help people feel more connected with the community. Madeline Bizzo has more.
In the middle of stacks of books, there are tables. Some have bowls of fruit or tea and coffee available, in some cases, even pancakes. The food is meant to connect people with the library and each other. Osa Ketchin says the additional $50,000 from the city will bring stability to the program. Ketchin is chief librarian and CEO for Halifax Public Libraries. She told City Council this week that their coffee corners can have up to 100 people come to them.
Food is a lovely point of intersection between people. So the simple act of providing a piece of fruit and a cup of tea to somebody actually invites them to settle in and to talk to somebody else in their neighborhood.
Currently, the food programs run through small grants and the occasional private donor. Ketchin says the new funding recognizes the importance of it.
It is about getting to know people by name. It's relatively small dollars that have a big impact on the behavior of people in our libraries, our ability to reach them, our ability to connect with them.
I think it's actually great.
Miriam Amari is a frequent visitor to the Central Library. She likes to have tea and talk with others there. She says it's an indication of how libraries are more open to the community.
Well, libraries aren't like they used to be, kind of silent and minding your own business.
Deputy Mayor Lisa Blackburn has seen the effects of food programs. She says at-risk youth in her community hang out at the Sackville Library. Through these food programs, staff gain their trust.
That is so incredibly important for young people who are experiencing homelessness or housing insecurity. An apple may just look like an apple, but boy, it does so much more.
Showing the truth to the old saying, the way to someone's heart is through their stomach. For The Signal, I'm Madeline Bizzo.
You're listening to The Signal, stories from the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism. I'm Amy Brierley.
And I'm Lucia Helder. Still to come on the show, our feature interview with a researcher on how government laws might be interfering with our love lives.
I do think it's important that government carefully consider the ways in which laws and policies might undermine our capacity to love.
And looking for love in all the wrong places? Check out some Valentine's weekend events. We'll have a roundup of what's going on around the city.
Today is Valentine's Day. We know love makes us feel good, but one researcher at Dalhousie University says it's also good for our health and our communities. John Cameron is a professor with the Department of International Development Studies. He's researching how governments regulate love. He's written an article in the Conversation Canada about how that impacts us all. Hello, Professor Cameron.
Great. It's good to meet you on the phone.
So when you say love, what do you mean?
That's a really good question. First of all, I want a full disclosure. I am not an expert on love. I came into this research really just as an outsider. It struck me as really important. So I'm very new to this field of research. But your question about love, research identifies different kinds of love. So there's the romantic love, which is probably the most immediate form of love that lots of your listeners will relate to. But there's also different patterns of love. So we can think about the love between parents and children, romantic love, platonic love between friends, as well as spiritual love, so the sense of connection that people have with something bigger than human beings, and then also what researchers refer to as cosmopolitan love, so the love of humanity or the love for people who you've never met. But of those kinds of love, it's the forms of love that have direct connections to other people, so primarily romantic love, parental love, and platonic love that seem to have the most important impacts on our mental health and physical health.
So in the article, you say governments around the world need to reflect on how laws and public policies may undermine people's capacity to love and be loved. What do you mean by that?
Right. So two things. The research points towards very powerful impacts of love on our physical and mental well-being. And given those impacts, I argue that governments should take love more seriously than they do. I would be very cautious, and I'm certainly not recommending that governments try to put in place laws and policies to help people love better, which I think could backfire in some really big ways. We can all imagine how that could go badly wrong if governments are trying to make us better lovers. But I do think it's important that governments carefully consider the ways in which laws and policies might undermine our capacity to love. And probably the most important way in which that happens is when governments, I think unintentionally, or at least the intent is not a direct impact, separate people from the others they love. So some of the recent examples in North America, we can think of the U.S. immigration detention centers that separate children from their parents. We can think in the Canadian case of migration, the de facto encouragement by some governments, including in the Maritimes, for workers to migrate to other provinces and even other countries to work, and that separates them from their families. We can also look at the cases of First Nations residential schools that separated children from their parents, and not just separated them, but really in many ways undermined the capacity of First Nations children to love because they didn't experience love in the residential schools. And we could also look at examples of the way laws against or that make illegal same-sex relationships have, if not undermined, at least seriously challenged the capacity of anyone who identifies as LGBTQ+ to express and feel love And that's a fairly recent struggle in Canada. We can take some of those rights for granted now, but it's not that long ago that same-sex relationships in Canada were really risky, and so it was much more difficult to express and feel love.
It's obviously not a good thing if governments are implementing these laws and policies that prevent people from loving. So why is it that love is so important to society?
I think anyone who has ever been in any kind of loving relationship with, I think, is hopefully almost all of us, we all know, I think, intuitively that it makes us feel better, that it contributes to our emotional well-being. But there's also a lot of medical research that explains kind of why love works. I kind of hate to medicalize love or to turn it into a science, but it does help us to understand why and how love is so powerful. So it works on a couple of levels. One, we know that stress is bad for us in a number of ways. So stress reduces the cell life, and that ultimately exposes us to illness, to disease. It shortens our life expectancy in the long run. And stress is often caused by negative emotions. So guilt, fear, anxiety, hate, all of the emotions you can think of that kind of get your body stressed out and anxious. Love works on a level that it counterbalances those negative emotions. So feeling love for other people and feeling loved by other people can counteract the surface level emotions that cause our bodies stress and it then has negative physical health impacts. Another way that love works is that it triggers the production and release of all sorts of amazing chemicals, neurochemicals in our bodies that make us feel better. And those chemicals also induce and inhibit stress. So by feeling loved and by loving other people, our bodies actually manage stress better, and that enables us to better deal with illness and disease. It strengthens our immune system. It slows down the process of cellular aging in our body. And so love, and again, the perception of feeling loved and the perception of loving other people is linked to positive impacts on just about every illness and disease. And just to cite one relatively recent study in Canada, it linked the positive impacts of feeling loved and loving, and the medical evidence supported that the positive impacts of love are greater than the negative impacts of daily smoking. And that's just something we don't hear very often. So, you know, you'd never hear of a health study in Canada that didn't look at the impacts of smoking. But we don't take love quite so seriously, and I'm simply arguing that we should.
So how would you say that the Canadian government tries to regulate love?
I think there are very few laws or policies in Canada that explicitly are linked to love, but there are a number of more subtle ways in which provincial and federal laws do try to recognize and at least not undermine capacity to love. So if we look at examples of family law in different provinces in Canada, and I am not an expert on family law, so these are surface level examples. For example, to get married in Canada, you can't simply walk into a for-profit wedding shop the way you could in Las Vegas and get married on the spot. There's a time delay between the time you say you want to get married and you can actually get married to try and ensure that people aren't getting married into loveless marriages. The same thing with divorce. The process can be slow, and that may be frustrating for some people, but it also creates the opportunity for a cooling-off period or second chances if people change their minds. Some more contentious cases, if we look at, we talked earlier about the example of the residential schools in Canada, as if that were history, but the ongoing separation of Indigenous First Nations children from their parents and caregivers and the placement of those children in foster homes is still very controversial, and it still continues at a rate that's much higher than the non-Indigenous population in Canada, which, again, is separating children from the people who are in the strongest capacity and strongest position to love them.
My next question for you is actually what you think some solutions are for getting governments to stop regulating love in this way, or if they should stop.
Yeah, I think the starting point is a stronger recognition of the medical, the physical health, the mental health importance of love, and the negative impacts, especially on children, the long-term negative health impacts of being separated from the people you love, who love you and who you love. And then, you know, from a government perspective, looking at the long-term financial costs of essentially lost love for governments. If we were able to put a price on love and recognize the dollar value of love and the cost of medical and mental and physical health terms, that might help to capture attention for why love is important and why we should take it more seriously. Governments around the world that have done this, that happiness should be an outcome of public policy. It may be that we also need to take love more seriously in the same way and examine and analyze these from the perspective of the impacts they have on the ability to love and be loved.
All right. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
John Cameron is a professor with Dalhousie University's Department of International Development.
Speaking of Valentine's Day, maybe you're celebrating friendship with your pals, exchanging flowers and chocolate with a significant other, or planning to treat it like any other day. I took a look at what's going on in Halifax this weekend, and whatever your style, there's surely something for you. If you're in the North End, keep your eyes peeled for North End Love Notes, a Valentine's initiative of the North End Business Association. I visited a local cafe to get their take on what they love about the North End.
How are you?
My name is Federico Pasquinelli. I run a little espresso bar in the North End. It's called Espresso 46. And it's in a warehouse. And we share the space with a farmer's market and the local fishery. And I opened the place 2.5 years ago. And it's become almost right away a meeting point for the North End community. And it's been a fantastic experience, and allow me and my family, which is my wife, family, and my kids, to feel home almost right away since we moved to Canada, because we met amazing people and we create this beautiful relationship within the warehouse, within the business in the warehouse, and with the community here, and it's been great. It's been great.
If you were to write a Valentine's card to the North End, what would you say it is?
Well, we thanks for the love, for the North End love, and that's what we celebrate in Valentine's Day, right? So it's a love celebration, and happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I feel like...
You can visit businesses in the area and collect the cards showing iconic North End scenes created by local artists. There are 4 different ones, and they're free, so you can spread the love at no cost.
That sounds really cool, Amy.
Yeah. And on Sunday morning, Lucia, you'll have another chance to get into the community spirit. The Lung Association of Nova Scotia is hosting their first ever Halifax Stair Climb. You can join their fundraising efforts by climbing the 18 flights of stairs at Scotia Square for fun or in the competitive heat. And you'll be climbing alongside firefighters with all their gear.
That sounds like a really tough workout.
I know, I get tired after just one set of stairs. And if you're looking for some music to start the weekend off, I'm hearing there are still some tickets left for Jen Grant's show tonight at the Rebecca Cohn.
That's our show for today. And in fact, the last show of our audio workshop. It's been fun being on the air here at CKDU.
If there's anything you want to hear again, we'll be posting a link on our social media feeds. Our handle is SignalHFX on Twitter and Instagram.
Thanks this week to producer Madeline Bizzo and associate producer Chelsea Claroux. Dominique Amit and Abigail Trevino are our social media editors.
Thanks also to our technician, Mark Pinio, in the control room.
Our audio professor is Pauline Dakin. Thanks for listening.
And have a great weekend.